Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'd like to thank Paul and all the members of the committee for allowing me to be a part of your weekend. I was so thrilled to see John and Karen this morning. And, you know, there's something very special. I think there always will be, I guess, for those of us who come in and we see the people that came in ahead of us. And John was an old-timer when I got here, for me, you know. And just to be able to be with them even for just a short time this weekend, it's really wonderful. I want to welcome those of you who are new or relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm assuming that you've been to other meetings this weekend at this conference. And so you already know that there's lots of different alcoholics, and we get here in different ways, and we have all different kinds of personalities. But I still want to go ahead and start out my talk by saying what I try to remember to always say, which is that I'm not an expert or an authority on alcoholism or Alcoholics Anonymous or anything else I'm going to be standing up here talking about this morning. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to try and follow what it suggests that we do in the format, just tell a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today. And I want you to know also, because so many people come to Alcoholics Anonymous in so many different ways, and sometimes people come into Alcoholics Anonymous through hospital facilities or treatment facilities. I really don't think it matters how you get to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do want to be sure to remind people, in case they did come in that manner and they were charged in some way for that program, which I'm sure was worthwhile, you know, in every capacity. But I want to be very clear that Alcoholics Anonymous itself is absolutely free. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not been free, I never could have come here. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not remained free, I never could have stayed. And I'm ever so grateful that it is. And I was also very grateful to hear Rick and the members of the committee mentioning that they try to keep the cost of this conference down. Because there's been many times, you know, in my sobriety. I mean, I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket when the seventh tradition came by. And I'm so grateful that the conferences that I've had the privilege of going to, and I was allowed to get to many because we have so many in Los Angeles, you know, that they would let me work at the registration table or sit at the literature table for a couple of hours or whatever so that I could have a badge and go to the meetings and get a part of what happens in conferences. Because I think conferences are really special. In fact, I've had one of those weeks this week where I really didn't need a meeting. I needed a convention. So it's nice to be able to get to one. I live a life today that I never would have wanted, and I'm a person today that I wouldn't have even liked when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what intrigues me so much about that is that most of the time I'm happy, and I'm the kind of person that was never happy. I wasn't happy before I started to drink. I wasn't particularly happy while I was drinking, believe it or not, and I was definitely not happy when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So happy was not even on my list. You know, it was just sort of not even anything that I ever aspired to be. And I know that many people, you know, are not going to relate to my story or the way that where I came from or how I got here, but I still believe that it's important that I tell it because someone might. You know, I spoke at a meeting a while ago, and a guy came up to me afterwards to thank me for sharing, mainly because his sponsor was standing behind him. And he said, "I want to thank you for your talk today." He said, "I like the way you told your story." He said, "I don't really believe it was your story, but I liked the way that you told it." And I've never forgotten that, because I thought, you know, it's only that we would sit here in Alcoholics Anonymous as new people and suspect that they're like making up stories, you know, just to fill in the time. They have nothing better to do with their life, come to meetings, you know, that kind of thing. And I enjoyed that. But what really impressed me about that sentence and that statement that he made is that when I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked exactly like my story. And I looked like my story for a hell of a long time after I got here. So it was really such a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous that someone could actually doubt that I came from where I was sharing that I came from, you know. I'm one of those people who believes I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with anybody about that after the meeting. It's just what I believe. you know, I just believe that because there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And I began to, my first obsession in life was suicide. And, you know, before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my memories go back to about 5 years old. I don't believe that there were any days before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else was likely to take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. And you know, when I think back on it and I've written inventory and tried to look, I can certainly see that some of my suicide attempts were to get attention. I don't have any problem with that. But the bottom line is up to and including this very moment, as I look back on it, I really and truly wanted to die. It wasn't just a passing thing that, you know, came upon me every once in a while. It was what I wanted. You know, I hated everything about me, and I hated everything about life. And everything about life hurt way too much for me. I did not want to play the game of living, ever. And for someone like me, I am so grateful that I found alcohol. I was 8 years old when I began to drink on a regular basis. I had already been using some different drugs for about a year at that time. By the time I was 9, I found a combination that allowed me to get by in life. And that was Seconal or barbiturates or downers or reds or yellows, whatever you might call them, and alcohol. And the combined effect of those got me where I needed to go. Now, I'm not a party girl. I've never had a social drink in my life. I don't have any cute, funny stories to tell you about my drinking. If you drank the way that I did and you mixed it with those kind of chemicals, you have a pretty boring story also. You know, I've thrown up a lot. I've overdosed a lot. You know, and that's pretty much all I did until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't out there drinking to party and to feel good. And I know that most of you probably won't even identify with that. I drank to not feel anything at all. And thank God alcohol worked for me, because I truly believe that the kind of person that I was, I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution if I hadn't found it. I couldn't make it out there, and I'm very grateful that I found it. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I knew a lot about alcoholism firsthand. I didn't know it was alcoholism, but I knew that something was a little off, you know. There was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of abuse in my home, and there was a lot of broken promises in my home. And there were a lot of the same kind of things that go on in a lot of alcoholic homes. But I didn't know it was alcoholism. Really, what I thought it was, my best guess was that it was weakness. And I never forgave my mother for being weak. And in my life, as I began to evaluate myself, I realized that I was weak too. And I never forgave myself for that either. Because to me, someone who was weak was basically someone who was not in complete control of their emotions at all times. And that was what I wanted out of life. Now, it seemed to me as I grew up, I looked at these two different groups of people, and before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know this is not necessarily true. I know today it's not true, but I certainly didn't know it then. I don't remember ever seeing a man cry under any circumstances. Now, I've seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen their wives leave them. Seen them get arrested. I've seen a lot of things happen. I never remember seeing a man cry under any of those circumstances. Now, I saw all the women in my life go through some or all of those same circumstances. Some of them didn't cry, but most of them did. There was some kind of a breaking point where one of those experiences just sent them over the edge. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And when I was a little kid, and they'd say, "Hey, June, what do you want to be when you grow up?" I said, "A boy." And it wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. But I was very serious. You know, it wasn't like some days I want to be a nurse and some days I want to be a teacher. It was like a boy. That is all. I want to be a boy. And my family was very concerned about that. My family is and was very active in their church. And they began to take me to priests for counseling and to discuss this, you know, because I didn't think it was, you know, quite right. Not to mention the little suicide attempts and things like that that were going on as well. And we were on welfare, and I think it was a priest that told my mom, I certainly don't know, but somehow because of that, they found out that I was entitled to see psychologists and psychiatrists. I began to see these people, these professionals. I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about why they thought I hated myself or why I tried to kill myself all the time or why I wanted to be a boy or anything else, because I felt about those kind of professionals the way my friend Patty Hicks always did. I thought those people should have to work for their money, and I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I never filled out one form. I never played with one doll. I sat there the required period of time, and when they were done, I got up and I left. And consequently, I wasn't able to get a lot of help from those people. And that certainly doesn't have anything to say about them. I mean, you know, it just gives you a little idea about where I was coming from. When I realized that I wasn't going to be able to be a boy, the next thing that came to mind as I saw the world, only option for someone like me, I'm from a town called Venice in L.A., and so I looked around and I just decided that the only thing that could work for me was to become a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming to AA trying to be a tough Venice broad. I spent some of the time after I got here trying to do that too. And you know, if you're going to be a tough broad where I came from, there were certain requirements. You had to be in a gang, and I was. You had to do a lot of fighting, and I did. It's important that I remember to let you know today that I've never won a fight in my life. But I never fought less than five people. I always fought groups of five or more. And what my sponsor explained to me after I got sober is, you know, if you fight one person and you lose, people might think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fight a group of five or more, then some people think you might be tough, because why would that many people have to jump you? You know, and that was sort of the way that I was. I made an unspoken agreement with myself to always make sure that people were much more likely to punch me in the face than they were to hurt my feelings. And the combination of my attitude like that and fighting that way and alcohol allowed me to get by that way pretty much. I would stand down on the boardwalk with my gang in Venice. And of course, tough broads don't wear shoes in Venice. Tough feet are very important. And I would take my cigarette when I'd see some touristy people looking at me, and I'd throw it down on the sidewalk and I'd put it out with my bare feet. And I'd see the touristy people whisper back and forth, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, that is one tough broad." And I knew they were pretty impressed. After I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor said, "You know, maybe some of those people were looking at each other saying, 'Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid?'" You know, but I didn't know there was another way of looking at it, you know. Anyway, those are the kind of things that kept me busy before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother. My mother had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years at that time with varying lengths of sobriety. She was coming back at that time, and she brought me to a meeting, not because I asked for help, not because I admitted having a problem, but simply because she thought I might get her evicted from another apartment if she left me alone. And I came into the meeting, and there was the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began that night, even though I did not get sober that night. It began because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. I did not admire very many people. I had very high standards for the people that I admired. And I admired this guy. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. And I'd seen him, you know, I'd known him since I was a little tiny kid, and he'd been in jails, he'd been in prisons, he had tattoos, he rode a motorcycle, had it with him at the meeting, he had a knife on at the meeting that day. He was one of the most hostile and violent people I had ever known. And I looked at him and I thought, wow, I did not think people this tough came to AA. I thought it was just for weak people like my mom. And it made a big impression on me. You know, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to AA, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. You know? But that's sort of what I wanted, you know. And Paul was the kind of guy, I'd seen him drinking in bars and at parties where my mom was, and if he'd been drinking and he wanted to sit at your table, I mean, you just gave him the whole table. You didn't even discuss it because you didn't know what he might do to get the table. And so I looked at this guy who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear rooms and tables. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to some meetings. I didn't raise my hand because I wasn't going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. And I spent my time explaining to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do, that I was very young, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who was tremendously alcoholic, and I was therefore, quite obviously, not alcoholic. I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. They already know that, you know. But Paul turned to me and he said, "You know, June," he said, "I've seen the way that you drink and I've seen the way that you use chemicals, and I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass." And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me like a teacher in school might do just to make up something to try and scare the kids. He was just talking about facts. He was just talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in my life. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't want to, you know, surrender that I was an alcoholic. I just couldn't believe that that could be it. And yet in that 2-week period of time, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I was living with my mother at that time and had been for a very short period of time. And because of the way that I was and because of the way that I felt about my mother, by the time I got to this program, the only person I hated more than my mother was myself. And I was filled with a lot of anger and rage and violence, and I used to attack my mom. And when she was drinking, other than fight back, she didn't do much about that. But now she was sober, and she didn't think she had to be attacked in her own apartment. She asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family, I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances. I hadn't bothered to try and do that. I had been in a lot of foster homes. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were in the L.A. area at that time. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And I thought, well, you know what, who cares about all that, those families and, you know, foster homes and, you know, all that, because none of that really matters. The only thing that really matters is your gang, if you're a tough broad. That's all that really counts. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. So I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn shoes if I'd had them. I had no money. I had no family. I had no place to live. And I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You could see where it was kind of a simple thing. You know, it wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? I mean, it was just a real easy decision at that point. I had no options. And, you know, I know today that there were some people in that room that didn't know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous that were read here this morning. And I know that they didn't know about the traditions, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I know that they didn't know about that tradition is because a few of those people who knew how old I was because of my mom and because I'd been coming to meetings with her for years came over to me and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back that they'd get together and ask me to leave. And I left that meeting that day, and I just figured Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. And that was okay with me, because I didn't want me either. And I had it for a long, long time. And I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited, and I found the kind of pills that I needed, and I took enough of them to kill myself one more time. And by the time I got to that noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that day, I could not stand and I could not sit. I laid in the meeting. I don't know about where you guys go to meetings out here, you know, but in West L.A., when I got sober, they almost never called on people to share who were laying in the meeting, you know. They did call on me that day. I certainly don't know what I said. I know that they realized I needed to be in a hospital, and that was where I woke up. And when I did wake up in that hospital, a doctor was explaining to me the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I can't really tell you why that was any different than all the other overdoses I'd inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was. I know that because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time. If I continue to do that, the 13th of July of this year, I'll celebrate 28 continuous years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to be really clear, particularly for those of you who are new, that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if they'd have asked me whether I wanted to go on living or not for 28 years or even for 1 year, I would have checked the no box. I'm not one of the people that stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid if I went back out on those streets I might die. I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there. I have always been afraid that I would be one of those people that could go back out there and continue to live the way that I was living. And by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not go on breathing in and out 2 more times, hating myself any more than I did. It was not possible for me to go on living that way anymore when I got here. And that self-hatred was to drive me here and keep me here, you know? And I'm very grateful for that. You know, I think that there was a tremendous amount of fabulous old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came in. And I suspect that there are for each and every one of us in our own area. You know, I was fortunate enough to be a member of the Monday Night Venice group. It was the greatest meeting in the world. You know, it was my home group, and I loved that meeting, and I never missed that meeting, ever. You know, I went to 21 meetings a week the first couple years that I was sober, not because I wanted to get a gold star in AA, not because I was great, certainly not because I was grateful, but because I had absolutely no place else to go. You know, I was thinking about it this morning. I have, you know, 500 things to do this morning, you know, before I could, like, get out the door and get here or whatever, you know. But I was remembering, you know, in the early years of my sobriety, I would go to the Los Feliz meeting, which was on a Wednesday night. And first I would go to a Wednesday noon meeting, which would get out at about 2. And the Los Feliz meeting started at 7. And it was quite a ways from where I lived. And I didn't have a car and I didn't have any money. And so I would begin to walk, or I would hitchhike, or I would take a bus, because it would often take me 4 hours to get to that meeting. But it wasn't any problem, because I had nothing else to do. No one that wanted to be with me, or, you know what I mean? I was just really on my own, you know. But I was just filled with trying to just get to meetings. It was the only place that I felt a tiny bit of comfort. And I had a commitment at most of those 21 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's very interesting, because it was, I was taught to take commitments, and it helped me to get to those meetings. And it also had to do with the fact that I couldn't put that dollar in the basket. And I hated that I couldn't put that dollar in the basket. And so I would go to my home group today, which is the Thursday night Brentwood meeting, and there were 420 chairs, and I would get there and I would slam down all 420 by myself, one at a time. But I figured that entitled me to sit through a meeting, even though I couldn't put a buck in the basket. And that was just what worked for me. And I'm very grateful, actually, that I came into the program not being able to put the dollar in the basket. Because I received so much more by learning to take those service commitments, and by getting to those meetings early, and by getting to know some other people, you know, because eventually someone else would come in with a bad attitude, and I'd let them slam a few hundred chairs down with me, you know, and we'd just slam them down one at a time. And it was just great, you know, just like this morning, even though I didn't know the people that stood up, it just felt good to see some people stand up from the class of 72, you know, which is the year that I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this may not surprise you, with a bad attitude. I had always had a bad attitude, and so I just brought it here. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't like men. I didn't like any men. I figured any of the men in here were alcoholics. The only men I'd ever known in my life were alcoholics. Most of them were extremely violent. I didn't like the men here. I didn't want anything to do with them. I didn't like women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. Figured any other women in here were probably like one of the two of us. I didn't like them. I didn't want to sit next to women. I didn't want to hug women. I most certainly did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better, because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like, you know. But I had a problem, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1972, all we had here were men and women, and I didn't like any of them, you know. But I went to 21 meetings a week anyway. I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. I found a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were extremely offended by the use of that type of language. So I tried to use it more when they got near me. I didn't wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I had a motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others," and then "split." It was kind of my own little spiritual, you know, slogan. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. No one ever lit my cigarette. Occasionally they'd hold a match, and I let them hold it as long as they liked, but they never lit my cigarette with it. After a while, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. And you know what I want to let you know is, if you choose to dress the way that I did and smoke the way that I did and to talk the way that I did, you too can sit in a meeting almost this big and have an entire row all to yourself. And so I'm extremely grateful to the people who were here in Alcoholics Anonymous and who tolerated me for what I was. I think they were far more tolerant than I would be up to and including today. What will I talk about? Well, you know, I can remember standing at the door at the Westwood meeting, 2+2. I was the greeter on Tuesday nights. So I would stand there barefoot with my motorcycle chains and cigar, welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. They'd walk by, and sometimes I'd hear their sponsor whisper, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that," you know. You know, when I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, those people who did not know how old I was, they were guessing my age at 37 years old. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 13. As I stand up here today, last week, I was 41 years old. And the fascinating thing to me is that at 41 years old, I feel at least 1,000 years younger than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't think that there was any other possibility for someone like me. I dropped out of school in seventh grade. I just went to 21 meetings a week, and I tried to get the kind of jobs you can get with a seventh grade education, and I went to lots and lots of meetings, you know, and that's kind of all, that was the best that I could do. And I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor because I went to 21 meetings a week. It seemed as though a woman named Gail Wilson spoke at about 18 of those meetings every single week. It was driving me crazy. I thought maybe if I asked her to be my sponsor, I could find out ahead of time where she was speaking, and then I wouldn't have to hear her all the time. And that was my motivation for getting a sponsor. And she became my sponsor. And Gail had clearly been taught to never say no to an AA request. And I verified that after, you know, in our relationship. And, you know, Gail would, I'd see her at the Thursday night Brentwood meeting, which was her home group at the time. And she would say, now, June, she'd say, don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight. I can't take the cigar smoke. And I'd say, okay. And then I'd turn and she'd say, and by the way, don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And that was fine with me because I didn't want anyone knowing I was hanging around with someone like her, because Gail and I were exactly what it means in the big book when it says we are people who normally would not mix. Not only did Gail not use the kind of language that I used, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. You know, Gail had come from a warm, loving family. I hated people like that, you know, and so I knew she didn't really understand, you know. And as if all of that was not bad enough, she had been seen in public on numerous occasions wearing shades of pink. So these were things that were just embarrassing for me, to have someone think that my sponsor, you know, wore pink or, you know, had, you know, didn't talk the way I did, those kind of things. So we would meet secretly after meetings and talk about AA. And, you know, I can remember so many of our conversations. Gail had such a hard time explaining things to me. You know, like I was thinking about this. I was listening to a tape the other day, and of Winnie E. And she was, you know, talking about being dishonest. And I can remember having this conversation with Gail. It took her months to explain this to me. I am the kind of person that I've always lied. I mean, that's just what you're supposed to do in life. And I prided myself on my lying because I was very creative about it. I lied by not telling you all the information. Now, if you asked additional questions, then you would have known the truth. But oftentimes people don't. So, for example, you might call up work and say, my car won't start. I won't be there today. I wouldn't mention I didn't put the key in. I didn't turn it. Those were the kind of things. They didn't ask that. Now, is that my fault? I'm just reporting a fact here. The car is not starting. You know, and so, now Gail, my sponsor, felt she was convinced that this was lying. And I went over it with her many times. But you know how it is with a sponsor, you know? I mean, I can remember a friend of mine, she says, you know, it's sort of like when you're talking to your sponsor, sometimes you're saying, what time is it? And they go, it's a horse. You know, they're not really helping you. You're just not quite in the same, you know, linguistic pattern here. You know, I can remember, you know, like in the early months, you'll call your sponsor up and you'll go, hello, I've got a really bad problem, okay? My rent is due tomorrow, and I don't have the money, and it's due tomorrow. Say, let's go to a meeting. Okay, let me go over it slowly for you. I'll use smaller words, okay? The rent is due tomorrow. And by the way, my landlord, they're not in AA, okay? So they really want money, you know, money, okay? And, you know, I never loaned anybody $2,500 when I was out there drinking, so there's not going to be like a check coming in the mail tomorrow, okay? So we've got a real problem here. This is very serious. They say, go to a meeting. You know, you're just like, it's no help sometimes, you know? And yet you go to a meeting and somehow things happen. You know, sometimes you get evicted, but things happen. Anyway. I heard a guy on a tape not that long ago, and he was talking, and he was saying, you know, he'd been sober a long time at the time, and he said, you know, if I had to credit the fact that I have maintained sobriety for this long, if I had to put it down to one thing, I mean, if I had to really narrow it down to the one thing that had made the difference, and it was the decisive factor in the fact that I have achieved long-term sobriety, if I had to just narrow it down to just one thing, he said, I'd have to say it's been not drinking. And I think that that's very true for me, because in Alcoholics Anonymous I've made all kinds of mistakes, you know, and I've done all kinds of stupid things, and I've been a flake, and I've been unreasonable, and I've been all kinds of, you know, things, and I've had all kinds of experiences, good, bad, and indifferent. And one of the ones that is tough is if I had my black leather jacket and leopard pants on. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's no problem. Because it's on the inside, the strength that I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't really tell you how that happened. I really can't. I can't give you an exact date, and I can't give you an exact time. But what I will tell you, which seems completely unrelated, and so I'm just going to pass it on, because it's going to be very much, especially if you're new, like, you know, when you say, what time is it, and they say, it's a horse. I will tell you that the thing that I believe that made the greatest difference in my life were keeping my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. Washing ashtrays, setting up chairs, doing the literature, being active in the committees that I was on, whether I wanted to or not, whether I liked the people there or not, whether I believed I was an alcoholic that day or I had just had a few misunderstandings. You know what I mean? Whatever it was, just to keep showing up so that I could be at the meeting, so that I could hear the things that I needed to hear, so that I could begin to change and my life could begin to change. You know, I don't live the way that I used to live. And as a result of your teaching me that, I don't feel the way that I used to feel. You know, I've heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have known people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they say, I was a drunken SOB, and today I'm a sober SOB. And I think that's just great for them. But what Gail Wilson told me is that I can have any kind of sobriety that I want. You know, and that Alcoholics Anonymous offers us what we need. And I got to tell you right now, I can't live the way that I used to live and stay sober. It's not possible for me. And so I've had to make some big changes. And again, it's been a process of giving up the old ideas, you know, and trying to make those changes. And I'm sure I have hundreds more to come. You know, the depth of my self-centeredness and my unawareness, you know, for me is really fascinating. You know, I just am amazed. You know, just like when I read the book and I see something, you know, after about 22 years, has that always been there? You know, I mean, I'd like to think I'm rather quick, but, you know, it took me 22 years just to even hear that it was in there, you know, so... It's just that kind of a thing. After I'd been sober for a while, I did go back to school, and I took a dummy English class. That's what they called it on campus, because I wasn't able to read, and I was tired of the jobs that I had with my seventh grade education. So I went ahead and I decided to try something, and I took that class, just the one class. It wasn't like I was going to go to college and get a degree or anything. I took one class. And I finished that class, and I had never finished anything in my life. And that was a big deal for me. I never missed a class. I had never done that either. I had never shown up for anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the first time where I began to practice these principles outside of a meeting room. And then I went ahead and I took some other classes, and then I ended up getting a job on campus that allowed me to take more classes. And I had two jobs so that I could support myself while I went to school. And at the end of about 3 years, they called me in the office and told me I'd completed the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. I thought it was a nice name for a college degree. I never wanted a college degree. It wasn't on my list, you know. But I was amazed that Alcoholics Anonymous had made it possible for me to accomplish something like that. I was just in shock because I knew it wasn't me. And after that, I had applied to a university, and I was accepted at a university, and I went on to college and began to do some footwork for a dream that I had, because my sponsor told me I had to do the same footwork in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous to have this dream come true. And I went ahead and I filled out these applications, and I received a telegram, and it's been, I think, 18 years now, something like that, telling me that I'd been accepted as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I'll tell you, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table, you know. And And that was an absolutely unbelievable experience, you know, for me to show up in law school. And it was hard. And it wasn't as hard intellectually for me as it was emotionally, because I still didn't feel like I was as good as other people. You know, I didn't feel like my family was, you know, was from where their family was from. I didn't even know a lawyer. You know, I knew Clint H., you know, and that's the only lawyer I'd ever known in my life. And it seemed like all these other kids, their grandmother was a lawyer, their grandfather was a lawyer, their uncle was a lawyer, the judge, you know, just like, oh my God, what am I doing here? You know, but it was such an important lesson for me. It was a wonderful time because I learned that what I believe and what has become very important for me is that we're all God's kids. You know, and that these people were no different, really, than I was. They don't have a disease called alcoholism, but some of them were practicing spiritual, you know, principles long before I was. And they didn't have to go to meetings regularly to be reminded of them, you know. And so it was really an interesting, you know, experience for me. And I began to just know that, you know, that I was one of God's kids, too, you know. And I wasn't any better than anybody else, and I wasn't any worse than anybody else. I just came from a different place and got there in a different way. And Alcoholics Anonymous had made it possible for me. I'm going to share about one other thing, I guess, or one other area. I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was single. And today, I think when you're 13, that's a good idea. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think so. My mother had never been married, and I'd always sort of thought, you know, maybe if she'd been married, you know, that things would have been different or okay, I think, you know. So I had this idea that that was, like, going to be the dream thing. So coming in here and being single was very hard. I still am the kind of person I would much rather fall in love than date. I'm not really a very good dater. And in West L.A., we have a lot of AA dates. I don't know if you have those here. That's where someone asks you out, and then you go to a meeting. I mean, where else would you go? And then after the meeting, you go to coffee and you talk about the meeting. And then by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer, you know. So had a lot of those, you know, kind of AA dates or whatever. I remember one of my dates, we were at the coffee stage of our date. And he said, you know, I really like you. And I said, well, thank you. He said, I really like your line. Thank you very much. He goes, but I like your girlfriend at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her? I go, well, no, not at all, you know, being tough and everything. And I went home and thought things through. Now, my sponsors have been able to convince me that I have never yet had a problem that has been as bad as my solution for it. But back then, I used to spend a lot of time thinking things through. And I like to do that in a room by myself, not answering the phone, because I might become distracted from my pain. So I didn't want that to happen. You know, it's kind of interesting. There's a song. I mean, it's, you know, old-time song, but it was, I think it was Carly Simon, I Haven't Got Time for the Pain. You know, and that's a little bit more about, you know, what feels true today. But in the early years of my sobriety, I had lots of time for the pain. I mean, I would set aside extra time for the pain. Sorry, I need to have a little more time for the pain. But anyway, when I was in law school, this guy asked me out, and I didn't really want to go out with him because he didn't have any tattoos. He'd never been in jail. I just wasn't sure we could work things out, you know. But we did eventually end up dating for quite a while, and then we decided to get married. I had never wanted to get married in the sense of the traditional, you know, kind of a thing. It was just sort of like a mythical kind of a thing. So it was just a really odd kind of experience that sort of unfolded. And I had never wanted to have kids. First of all the physical problems that I'd had after I got sober, I had many, many surgeries and things that happened, and I was hospitalized a number of different times. After I got sober, and they just told me I'd done so much damage to my body that at 15 they told me I needed to have a hysterectomy. And it was only a question of waiting until I was 18 where I would have some kind of insurance before someone would do that operation. And so I had known that I was not going to have kids, and I guess I just sort of had accepted that, and I didn't even have it on my list. And when we got married, my husband knew that I had these problems and that we probably were not going to have children. But we decided to go ahead and talk to a doctor and try, and we did, and I had a miscarriage, and then I ended up getting pregnant. I had our little daughter, Samantha, who's going to be 9 next week. About 6 months later, I had a very bad case of the flu, I thought. But really, I was pregnant with my second daughter. They called it Irish twins, you know, the doctor said. It was just one baby then, but they were so close together that they were called Irish twins. It was very cute. I had my second daughter, Jessica. A couple of years later, I had my third daughter, Cassandra. I'm working on kind of a USA women's basketball team here. So my husband was kind of thinking, he said, I thought we were going to have one. I thought, well, I'm an alcoholic. If one is good, you know. Anyway, you know, I there isn't a day that goes by in my life that I don't think about Norm Alpe, who was one of my favorite speakers of all time when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time I heard Norm talk after the meeting, I'd think, I want to join AA. And then I'd remember I already joined, or I wouldn't be there hearing him talk, you know. But he was just so incredibly enthusiastic. And one of the things that Norm would talk about is he would talk about, you know, if it were for the grace of God and rooms like this and people like you, I could have missed it all. You know, and as I walk through the lives with my kids, you know, being able to show up and being able to be there, it's unbelievable to me. You know, it wasn't even on my list. And yet I'm able to be there, you know, and to show up. And I've learned so much, you know, from women in Alcoholics Anonymous and out, you know, about having to be a parent and showing up and, you know, and whatever. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful journey. I want to tell you one story about my middle daughter, and then I'm going to sit down. You know, I read different spiritual literature every morning. And I'm one of those people, I'm kind of a story person. I'm not really the best at names. But if you tell me that it was the guy whose Doberman drank vodka, I'll remember the story. But I won't remember that it was John that told the story, you know. So I love little stories, and so some of my spiritual literature has to do with little stories because it just sort of sticks in my mind. I'm reading this one story one morning, and it's about Gandhi. And Gandhi was running to catch a train to go to another place and give a talk. And as he was running, he sort of tripped, and one of his sandals fell off. And he lost the sandal, and he jumped to catch the train with his, you know, the people that were with him. And as soon as he got on the train, he reached down, and he pulled off his other sandal, and he threw it back. And some of his followers, they said, hey, Gandhi, what are you doing? I mean, why'd you do that with your sandal? He said, well, if someone came along and they found one sandal, it would be of no value to them. But at least perhaps someone could make use of a pair. So I thought about this story, and I thought, that is remarkable. I mean, I'm one of those people. If I lose the back of an earring, all right, it can ruin my week. Okay? I know it was here. Where was it? Did you move it? Where could it be? I'll go through here again. You know what I mean? I can, like, just go over and over and over. Where did I put the, what, you know? I mean, there's never a thought of just throwing the other earring out into the, you know, environment so that, some, you know, I mean, just like, I just think that's an amazing thing. You know, and he didn't even think about it because he didn't have time to think about it. Now I'll think about it. I'll think, well, I did lose one earring. Maybe I should leave the other one. Yeah, but what if I find the other? You know, I mean, I've got to write an inventory, call my sponsor, you know. And Gandhi's are, you know, the train is gone, you know. So anyway, about 6 months ago, I'm running with my daughter out of school, and we go to climb in my big truck. And as we're climbing in my truck, she drops her shoe. She goes, oh, Mom, I lost my shoe. I go, you're kidding. She goes, no, it came off when I was getting it. I go, all right. So I go out of the car, the truck, and I go around, and I try to lay in the street to pick up her shoe, but there's a storm drain there. The shoe has fallen into a storm drain. I go, Jesse, I can't get this shoe. It's in the storm drain. Now, by the way, I've never told my children about this little story that I read, right? This is like rambling in my mind. She says, Mom, should I throw the other one in there? I think, my God, I'm living with Gandhi, you know? I don't know. Anyway, I just want to tell you, in case anybody's sitting out there in one of those long, dark hallways that all of us seem to go through at different periods of time, I hope that you won't give up until your miracle happens. I have no idea what your miracles are going to be, just as I've had no idea what mine were going to be or what they're going to be in the future. But I hope you'll keep coming back, because it's really an amazing journey. Thanks for letting me be part of your weekend.